Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The 2020 Democratic presidential primary field is getting crowded. 12 Democrats have already announced their bids for president. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders joined the fray this week, picking up where he left off in his failed Democratic primary bid against Hillary Clinton. In a recent CBS interview, he said the party is just catching up.
So what this campaign is about is understanding that 3 years ago, we began the political revolution. Now it's time to complete that revolution and to take that vision and implement it into reality.
So you're saying the party came your way?
Well, I don't want to say that. I think most people would say that.
Okay, he's not saying it. Most people would say that. We're talking about that and more national politics with the host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin. We'll post a link to the podcast at WOSU.org/allsides. Ken Rudin, welcome back.
Good morning, Ann.
Are you among the most people?
I am. Well, you know something? Yes, he did start that revolution and he got further in 2016 than anybody would have imagined. But 2016 is not 2020. By my math, and I was always very good at math, he is 4 years older. Mm-hmm. And he's also, so that means he's 77 years old. But more importantly, he is no longer the sole anti-establishment candidate on the Democratic side. There are many who have taken Bernie Sanders' views and have run with them. And the difference is they're younger, they are people of color, they're women, and it's not in a simple one-on-one Bernie versus establishment, as we saw in 2016.
It's almost like the whole party's going that route, though. He does make an interesting point there. I mean, some have said that they don't buy into the Medicare for All and this and that, but they're all kind of anti-establishment.
They are, and of course, if the establishment is Donald Trump, then they're certainly all anti-establishment. And whether they're all for the Medicare for All and free colleges and some of the more, shall we say, more radical is not the word I want to say. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, they want to get to the same place that Bernie Sanders wants to get to. Maybe people like Sherrod Brown, Amy Klobuchar, others like that, maybe more willing to go a little slow. Bernie Sanders, on the other hand, is more impatient and he wants to do it quicker. And, of course, that sets him separately from the rest of the field as well.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. That familiar voice, Ken Rudin, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. Miss you, Ken. Haven't talked to you in a while.
I know. And, but this, you know something, even if we did this show every day,
I know,
it wouldn't be enough, or with me and you. There's something that happens as soon as we get off the air. So it's just, look, I mean, if you're a political junkie, this is exactly the time to be following politics. If you're somebody who cares about the future of the country, you may be a little nervous, but it's still a very exciting time.
You know, I knew it was going to be exhausting after the 2016 election, just following up on all the issues, and it certainly has been. But now as we look down the barrel of a 2020 presidential cycle, I'm kind of getting, my legs are already starting to shake. It's going to be busy.
Well, we always say, you know, we always say this every 4 years, that this election is going to be the most consequential in our lifetime. And often they are, but there's something about 2020 that makes me feel that this one is very significant, because there is a difference. I mean, there's always a difference between the two parties. I mean, we saw this, Johnson and Goldwater were different, and Reagan and Carter were different, and Obama and McCain were different. Mm-hmm. So, of course, there's so many things that differentiates the two parties. But this one just feels, maybe it's because there's so much anger in this country, mm-hmm, on both sides, on the right and on the left. And hopefully politics will take care of that anger. But I fear that that may not be enough.
There are there's a wide variety out here in the Democratic field. Anybody particularly intrigue you?
Well, you know something. First of all, we haven't seen the end of the field yet.
Right.
I mean, we're still waiting for the rest of the killer bees. We had Bernie this week, but what about Biden and Beto and Bloomberg and Sherrod Brown, and of course the one everybody's talking about, Steve Bullock, the governor of Montana. He's a beaut. But anyway, the point is, I mean, this is going to be a gigantic field, and it already is a pretty big field. We already have 6 United States senators. We have a bunch of women. We have 5 or 6 women. I mean, you know, once upon a time, it was Hillary Clinton, or it was Shirley Chisholm, but it was not, you know, or Pat Schroeder from Colorado. Mm-hmm. We talk about the one woman. But now it's just the Democratic Party has changed. The country has changed. And that's reflected in the Democrats who are running for president.
So six U.S. senators, you mentioned Joe Biden, the bees, the killer bees, Biden, Beto, Bloomberg, right. Brown, and the governor of Montana bee. I can't remember his name. But
Steve Bullock.
Bullock. So let's just go through Biden. One of the things that people are saying about Bernie Sanders is, as you mentioned, do the math. He's 4 years older. He's also white male. Maybe in a year that just isn't going to generate that much interest in a white male. He did raise $6 million in one day. So he's still got that going for him. But what about Joe Biden and that ilk? Is it?
Well, first of all, let's not dismiss the fact that Bernie Sanders raised $6 million within 24 hours.
That is pretty
remarkable.
Exactly.
And given the fact that he still has a mailing list of 2.5 million donors, which he's kept up since 2016, means, you don't dismiss him. Yes, he's 77 years old. Yes, he was very valiant during the War of 1812. But the fact is that he retains a tremendous amount of loyalty among his supporters from 2016. And he's definitely a force to be reckoned with. Biden is interesting because, yes, he's also in his mid-70s. Remarkable that as the country is getting younger, that as the Democratic Party is getting younger, we're talking about Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden, both in their mid-70s, which is, and of course you have a president of the United States, Donald Trump, who's 74. This mm-hmm. is just much different than we've ever, come across in our past. But Biden, it's not that Biden is white, and it's not that Biden is a male. The thing is, Biden may have, I don't know if time has passed him by, but the fact is that the Democratic Party seems to be angrier than it's ever been before. Certainly they were angry under Bush. They were angry under Reagan. I mean, everybody likes to be angry, but they're especially angry now. And Biden, you just wonder if, that he's a beloved guy. He served 8 years, very productive years as vice president, a very loyal vice president. Mm-hmm. But, the old line about Joe Biden, that he wanted to be president in the worst way, and it showed that he ran for president in the worst way in 1987 and 2008. And you just wonder if he just has that fire mm-hmm. that so many of the candidates currently have.
Mm-hmm. Give me your thoughts about how Sherrod Brown is pulling this off. He hasn't announced or anything yet. It's a lot of people say it's just a matter of time. But what do you make of his dignity of work campaign?
Well, first of all, he's been doing that kind of a tactic ever since he was first elected to the Senate in 2006. And what I like, what hits me about Sherrod Brown, and to the same extent Amy Klobuchar, is that, yes, it's good. You could talk about Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders and Kamala Harris and Cory Booker, but they are on the coasts, which some people will make the case that are the argument that they don't represent middle America. Donald Trump won the election in middle America by winning in Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania and Ohio and Iowa. And maybe if you have a candidate from Ohio or Minnesota or somebody who speaks Midwest talk, maybe that's where the country is. And maybe that's what wins the election for the Democrats in 2020. And so I kind of think that, I actually thought that Sherrod Brown was going to be Hillary Clinton's running mate in 2016. Mm-hmm. I thought that that would certainly help with Ohio, and mm-hmm. it probably would have. I don't know if Sherrod Brown, I'm not convinced he runs. I think he runs, but I'm not convinced he runs. You could say, there's not much room for him because it's such a crowded field. But who has the advantage? Who's the front runner? I know the media loves to talk about, he or she is the front runner. That's nonsense. I mean, mm-hmm. the voters won't have a say until February of 2020. Mm-hmm. So I think for now, the more the merrier. Let's hear what they have to say. And as long as they get in before the first debates come in June, and so everybody says, is Sherrod Brown wasting time? Is Joe Biden wasting time? They certainly have plenty of time to make their announcement and get their staffs together, but time is running short. And again, they got to be in the race before June when the debates start, and then the American people could see what the choices are.
Hmm. I'm just thinking of those Republican debates, primary debates, the fiasco of that.
Well, it wasn't, you know, something, because there were so many candidates, right? And they couldn't all fit on the same stage.
Well, you could never get enough out of them to make a judgment about what they were trying to say.
Well, except for the fact that I think that one thing the debates showed is that Jeb Bush didn't have the – I thought Jeb Bush was the front runner. Mm-hmm. I love that word. Was the front runner in 2016. I thought he was going to be the Republican nominee until he couldn't describe in the debates why, you know, about talk about his brother's Iraq war policy. He just mm-hmm. seemed very tentative. Mm-hmm. And whatever you think of Donald Trump, he commanded the stage. The media loved him. I mean – one of the reasons I think Donald Trump is president is because CNN and others like that couldn't get enough of Donald Trump in 2016. He's amazing. He's interesting. He's spontaneous. Maybe they rue that decision back then. But those debates were very instructive. It told the Republican voters who was real and who was not. And I suspect we'll see the same thing for the Democrats in 2020.
Some people are emerging that are just interesting to me. The mayor of South Bend, Indiana, openly gay now. He's an interesting guy. I mean, I don't know what their chances are, but it does. The field does look more interesting. You kind of think, well, you're right. I mean, you said that before it was just the few, the super famous, but is this a more of a field? Is this what am I trying to say? Is this good news for the Democrats going forward, regardless of who ends up with the nomination?
I think it is. I think it is. I mean, there were a lot of charges made against Hillary Clinton and the Democratic National Committee in 2016 that it was rigged.
Yeah.
That the establishment was going to do everything they can to nominate Hillary Clinton and defeat Bernie Sanders. And even at the Democratic convention that summer in Philadelphia, and I was there, I was talking to delegates. There was still a lot of Bernie supporters who didn't like Hillary. There were a lot of Hillary supporters who didn't like Bernie, that it was just, you know, suspicions and mistrusts and things like that, where now I think, sure, the more the merrier. And some look, remember Jimmy Carter was Jimmy who for mm-hmm. the longest time when he was running around the country in 1975, trying to explain that this former peanut farmer and former governor of Georgia was a possible president. So, you know, you mentioned Mayor Pete, and I think we call him Mayor Pete because nobody in the world could pronounce Buttigieg.
I noticed I didn't try to. But, Buttigieg.
Yeah, but Buttigieg. Yeah, Buttigieg. Buttigieg. But look, I mean, he's an interesting guy. I think he's like 16 years. No, he's not 16 years old. But I think he's like 32 years. Oh, he can't be 32.
I think he's in his 30s.
To be 35 to be president. So he's certainly young. I mean, obviously he has to be constitutionally allowed to be elected president. But, I mean, he's young and maybe he's a few. You know, I mean, there's talk about a lot of people running now. Maybe he'll run for governor of Indiana one day, or just like for example, Stacey Abrams in Georgia, mm-hmm. who they're talking about as a possible candidate. But maybe they're talking about her, and she'll run for the Senate from Georgia. So not everybody is going to be president. Obviously, not everybody's going to be the nominee or on the ticket. But the more public scrutiny they get and more visibility they get, they could lead to bigger and better things down the road.
We are talking politics today with political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. It is well known that Ken Rudin prefers callers' questions over mine. So,
no, that's not true.
Get those calls in right now. 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking politics this hour with political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Ken, how much do you think people are still into politics? What do you think the 2016 election did to the nation of political junkies?
Well, just as Barack Obama and Ross Perot and people like that seem to bring more people into the process, I think both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders brought in a lot of people who either been disillusioned or just fed up with politics or didn't even care about politics. And the fact that they were running, and they were clearly running against the status quo, brought more people in. Now, again, I think the toxicity of politics is worse than ever. I really feel that way. I think some of the things we're hearing from some of our elected leaders is disturbing and frightful sometimes. But I, at the same time, I don't know anybody who just is not constantly thinking about it, talking about it, and perhaps worrying about politics. And as somebody who's loved politics as long as I have, I mean, I've been, you know, I go back to the days when Frank Lausche was mayor. You know, I've been following politics. No, that's not true. But I mean, as politics for so long that I could only say that, I mean, given somebody who just loves government and Congress and elections as much as I do, I'd rather more people talk about it than not. And I think that more people are smarter. I think people are smarter than ever before about what people are standing for and what the issues are at stake. So I am encouraged.
Well, I go back long enough so I at least know who you're talking about when you say Frank Lausche. I actually know how to spell his name. That scares
Pete
me.
Buttigieg.
Of course, served as mayor of Cleveland, governor of Ohio, and also in the United States Senate. That is
defeated by whom? Defeated by whom?
I don't know who he was defeated.
John Gilligan.
Oh, another former governor. Yeah.
That's right.
All right. Well, Chris in Asheville, you're on the air. Hi, Chris.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good, thanks.
Ken, I wanted to ask you, what do you think of Andrew Yang? Everybody started talking about Howard Schultz as soon as he said something about running. And I'm like, what's his policy position? Andrew Yang, I hear an interview and I'm like, this guy's incredible. Straight shooter, no foolishness, substantive and everything, but nobody talks about him. Just want to hear what you have to say. Thanks a lot.
So he's the founder of Venture for America. He filed to run for president in November, I think, it's 2017.
Yeah, he's running. You know, when people say there are 12 people running for president, I'm saying, well, wait a second, I could count 10, but there's Marianne Williamson, the former guru somebody. Mm-hmm. And Andrew Yang, look, he's a tech executive, very smart. He's 44 years old. But he's talking about, you know, a universal income funded by the government, which is kind of unique. I love English language. It's kind of a unique policy. And I think people are paying attention to him. But when you have a field like it is now, I mean, maybe he'll be able to raise money to become more visible. But when the media love to talk about those who are in office and the familiar faces, you know, mm-hmm. the Bidens and the Bernies and the record field of women who are running,
right,
it's hard to get that kind of attention. But again, assuming he makes it into the debates, and my understanding is they may have to have 2 days of debates because all the Democrats won't be able to fit on the stage. And that's true. I mean, that's what happened with the Republicans.
Yeah.
They were the kids' table. The Republicans had the kids' table, which I thought was a mistake. I think what the Democrats should do is just, you know, maybe perhaps by lot, you know, and just to have them 2 days, you know, put them in by height or something. I don't know. I mean, but I don't think you should decide the MSNBC shouldn't decide these are the front runners and these are the also-rans. That would be a big mistake.
Thanks for that call. Anybody else out there have a question or comment for Ken Rudin? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I was a little surprised that Bill Weld sort of came out of retirement. Former governor of Massachusetts announced he'd formed a presidential exploratory committee. I thought his day had come and gone.
Well, he's also 73 years old. You know, it's interesting. I mean, again, it's a young country, and we're getting more and more candidates in their 70s. But Bill Weld, look, he's one of those never-Trumpers, and it's one thing to be opposed. There are some Republicans. There are, you know, not too many of them, certainly not in Congress, but there are Republicans who don't like what Donald Trump is doing to the country, let alone to the Republican Party. Bill Weld may not be the best person to make that case because, as you point out, yes, he's a two-term former governor of Massachusetts. He was very popular. I think he got 70-plus percent when he was reelected. But at the same time, he left the Republican Party in 2016 to run as the vice president under the Libertarian Party. Mm-hmm. And then at the closing days of that election, he said, well, I don't have a chance, so I think everybody should vote for Hillary Clinton. And let's not forget, in 2008, he backed Barack Obama over John McCain. Mm-hmm. So look, Bill Weld is a Republican. He's a social, a fiscal conservative, but he supports gay rights and abortion rights. And there's nothing wrong with that, but try saying that out loud mm-hmm. at a Republican National Convention and see how far you get. So I think he may, you know, I mean, whenever I think of Bill Weld not getting anywhere, then I think of the other guy who may be preparing a challenge, and that's John Kasich. Mm. But again, I don't know what the reception would be for a non-Trump Republican, because this has become Donald Trump's Republican Party. I mean, it's clear when you look at the people like Mitch McConnell, who once upon a time had principles and said that, for example, it would be wrong for the president to come up with emergency powers to bypass Congress and spend money for the wall. He was advising against that for the longest time. And lo and behold, last week, you see Mitch McConnell on the Senate floor saying, I backed the president completely on this emergency power thing. So principle seems to have gone out the window for too many Republicans in Congress. Weld seems to be one of those Republicans who really believes in what the party stands for, but I'm not sure he's the best vehicle to make that case.
Sheila in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Sheila.
Hey, Ann. My question for Ken is, it used to be fairly rare for a senator to run for president. It was almost like they were overstepping their bounds. And governors ran. It was like going from the executive branch to a larger executive branch. So what does Ken think the difference is now? Why is it so different?
Well, I don't think it's rare that senators have run. It's certainly rare that senators have been elected in history. There's only been three, one from Ohio. You had Warren Harding mm-hmm. in 1920. You had JFK in 1960. And you had Barack Obama in 2008. Those are the only senators who've ever gone from the Senate to the presidency. But we, you know, we've always had senators who have run. Hubert Humphrey, Scoop Jackson, Birch Bayh. You know, there's been a lot of senators who have sought the presidency. They just weren't successful. I don't know what it is. I think that more and more senators, I guess, with the hearings, I think they deal with more and more issues. They're more and more visible than they used to be. But I think the difficulty, of course, in being a senator is that you have the tendency to cast difficult and controversial votes that could be thrown against you when you run for president. And I think that's why, you know, one of the reasons, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why Barry Goldwater and George McGovern got clobbered when they ran for president. But they also took very controversial issues in the Senate. When you're a governor, you know, you're an executive. You need to make government working. You need to make sure that the roads are paved and taxes are collected. So I think it is different this time. It will be interesting to see what happens. But again, you know, Hillary Clinton was a senator in 2000 in 2008 when she ran, and Bernie Sanders is a senator running again. We'll see how successful they are. I mean, look, Donald Trump had no experience at all. And lo and behold, he's the 45th president of the United States. So go figure.
Yeah, right. Let's see. Walter in Columbus, you're on the air with Ken Rudin. Hi, Walter.
Hey, good morning. I love listening to you. Thank you. Appreciate this gentleman coming on right now and talking. My question is with all these candidates running for the Democratic Party, isn't it going to be confusing again because what the Republicans were at least able to find one common person to at least stand behind, and now all these other people trying to run on the same ticket, won't that be confusing for voters again?
I don't know about confusing. I kind of think that, look, you know, I mean, as I said, nobody knew who Jimmy Carter was until he did really did well in the Iowa caucuses in 1976, and he won New Hampshire with only 29% of the vote when he was when he won the primary in New Hampshire, but he got the newspaper headlines. So it, right now, you know, they all blend in. We don't know how to pronounce Buttigieg, Buttigieg. I keep mispronouncing it, but again, things will see something in the debates. I mean, it won't always have to be Rick Perry, who's remembered for, you know, forgetting which budgets, which departments will cut and failing in the debate. Sometimes people will stand out. So we'll remember that, and one person will win, and one person will come close, perhaps in Iowa, New Hampshire. So I think right now it is very confusing, but look, who thought in 2015 that Donald Trump had a chance at the nomination? He was a curiosity, but he was not going to win the nomination. He was not going to be elected president. So I'm not worried about people not getting a good, clear sense of who the Democrats are. We have plenty of time. We have almost a year. We have 50 weeks or so till Iowa, 51 weeks till New Hampshire. We have the debates coming up in June. Don't get nervous yet, but but if we still don't know what's going on in Iowa and New Hampshire, then Ann will get me back on the show and I'll apologize to you.
Let's talk about Donald Trump. In a public ceremony after signing the National Emergency Declaration to build the border wall, Donald Trump singled out the new attorney general, William Barr, and he wished him luck and speed and told him to enjoy his life. It was awkward. A lot of times his unscripted stuff does come across that way. But then he turned to Twitter over the weekend and started trashing the Justice Department. I'm just kind of wondering, what kind of position does that put Barr in? Is this the same thing he's done to every single person and he just is going to keep cutting them off at the knees?
Yeah, the front page of the Washington Post yesterday said that that Trump has soured on Dan Coats, who's the director of National Intelligence. I mean, he's just given up on Dan Coats, who's, of course, a former Republican senator from Indiana. So he does tire on, you know, he has favorites, the president has favorites, and then he gets rid of, you know, he sours on them pretty quickly. But you know something? I watched Saturday Night Live after that Friday event in the Rose Garden, and I'm saying, why do you need Saturday Night Live? Just show Trump's appearance in the Rose Garden. It was so surreal, and I didn't know if that was Alec Baldwin or Donald Trump in the White House. I mean, talking about the things he talked about and talking about how he's going to be nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize and how Barack Obama was about to start a nuclear war with North Korea.
Wow.
and he's the best liked president in history, and it's just remarkable. But I know, look, there's no question that if you're going to tweet over and over again about the lying FBI and the lying Justice Department and the fake news and all that, one suspects that he is nervous, and he may have reason to be nervous, given most reports that the Mueller report is perhaps a week or two away from being released. We don't know what Attorney General Bill Barr is going to do with it once he gets that stuff. I suspect that Barr is telling the truth and that he will let Mueller do what he needs to do. The question is how much of it will be made public. And you know that if some of it is all we get is a Barr summary, the Democrats will go ballistic, and then, you know, more investigations will be going on in the Democratic House. But I think we're getting close to, you know, all the money that Trump says is being wasted on this investigation. Look, Watergate took, you know, 2 years as well between the break-in and the resignation. That was over 2 years. Mm-hmm. So we're about the time when the investigation seems to be coming to a close. There's still a lot of questions about Roger Stone, but those investigations will continue because there are U.S. attorneys, there are federal prosecutors in New York who are not letting go of this investigation. But it's coming close. The fact that Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, is talking about leaving in mid-March makes me think that we're coming to the end of it, and we'll see. Will it be indictable? Will it be impeachable? Will it be just bad political? We don't know, but my goodness, Donald Trump is as nervous and anticipating this as much as the rest of us are.
Do you think that the books by
Andrew McCabe, for example?
Yeah, right, yeah. What do you make of that? I mean, former FBI director, he's written this book. The other day he said it's possible that the president is a Russian asset.
Well, you know something, I mean, it's interesting. When you have the head of the FBI, and of course, Andrew McCabe was the acting director after James Comey was fired.
Right.
When you have the acting director of the FBI saying that the president of the United States, I mean, my God, that the president of the United States might be a Russian operative, I would say, my goodness, something is going on here. And so when you hear Lindsey Graham, who's the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, saying, I want to investigate the FBI because of a charge like this, not investigate the president of the United States. Wow, I mean, we're just... The question is, here's the real question. What happens when Mueller releases a report? And let's just say it does become public. And let's just say it is damning. And let's just say that half the people in the country don't buy it. They don't agree with it. They don't. Right. They think it's tainted or political or biased. Then what have we? Where are we? And so, you know, I was talking about my optimism a few minutes ago, but mm-hmm. I still have this fear that something could be, you know, that there could be some real damning things in this report, and half the country and perhaps a good portion of the Congress will either shrug their shoulders or saying it's just fake news, and you know, we just back where we started.
We're going to get to some calls. If you want to go a call and talk with Ken Rudin, the number is 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org, and we'll get to some calls and more questions for Ken Rudin when we return. We're talking politics with the host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. We'll have a link to that on our website at wosu.org/allsides. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking national politics this hour. Still with us, political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. Ken Rudin will have a link to the podcast on our website at wosu.org/allsides. So check that out. Ken, what about this emergency order? I'm wondering, you know, what the military's thinking. He's talking about tapping other military money for some of those funds.
Well, I think in addition to wondering what military is thinking, we should ask what the Congress is thinking, because as far as I know, and I kind of read the Constitution, I didn't see the movie, but I read the book.
Oh, that's right. They have to approve it, don't they?
Well, that's exactly it. Congress controls the power of the purse. They're the ones who decide where money is spent. So, yes, there have been several, like maybe 60 instances where the president has called, you know, declared a national emergency and you know, irrespective of what Congress decides. But I don't remember ever a time where the president has gone to Congress, asked for money, the Congress has said no, and the president said, well, that's okay, I'm going to spend the money anyway. That's my understanding, is that's not the way it works. And I think that, you know, while Congress can be very upset and be livid, and they are livid, Nancy Pelosi said yesterday that she's going to call a vote in the House to, you know, reject that his emergency power. And even if the Senate, the Republican-controlled Senate goes along with it, the fact is that there are not votes to sustain a veto, which is likely to come. But it's interesting what the courts will say. It's, you know, you remember that that when Trump was in the White House at the Rose Garden last Friday, and that sing along, well, we're gonna go to Sixth Court, Seventh Court Circuit, and then we're gonna get defeated, and then we're gonna. I mean, I thought he was reciting his bar mitzvah the way he was just, you know, reading. I don't know. I didn't know what that was. But I mean, the fact is that it will be decided in the courts, and it may not be unconstitutional. It certainly seems not the way Congress decided what should be done. But there are a lot of questions. I mean, you know, who decides who's spending? Is it Congress's jurisdiction? I always thought it was, but mm-hmm. the courts have always been often been afraid of limiting presidential powers, and so that'll be a very fascinating series of decisions, because it's not going to end with the seventh of the federal district court in San Francisco.
Bob and Pataskis.
I mean, we also saw like 16 state attorneys general file a lawsuit. You know, I mean, that's the lawsuit they are filing. And of course, in a sense, it reminds me, it's like a mirror image of what happened in 2014 when like 17 Republican state attorneys general sued Barack Obama over what he did with allowing keeping people here, undocumented aliens here, keeping them from deportation and giving them job training and things like that. So a lot of it is politics, but it's also constitutional, and we'll see what the courts decide.
Bob in Pataskala, you're on the air with Ken Rudin. Hi, Bob.
Hi. It seems to me that Trump wasn't so much elected as Hillary was defeated. In other words, a lot of people voted against Hillary rather than for Trump. That being said, and the Dems lost by the skin of their teeth, now they want to go away from the middle. Why won't they just stick with what works?
Well, wow. I mean, that's a great question that is being debated in the Democratic Party right now. There are so many different reasons why Hillary Clinton lost. Was she a terrible candidate? Did she fail to go to Wisconsin? Did James Comey announcing 11 days before the election that he's opening up the email scandal again? There are so many reasons why. But the fact is that she was... She was the third Obama term, and yes, she would have made history had she been elected the first woman. And I'm not diminishing that at all. But there were just so many reasons why Hillary Clinton failed, and you don't know does that mean a woman can't win? I mean, that's the question that Amy Klobuchar and Kirsten Gillibrand and Kamala Harris and others have to decide, or is it that she was the wrong candidate? So. And yes, and she did get about 3 million more votes than Donald Trump. So she did get more, she certainly the polls were right. I mean, they said that she would win and she got 3 million more votes. So there is that. But I'm trying to put my finger exactly on why she lost and whether they should emulate what Hillary Clinton did in 2016 in 2020. The fact is, as Bernie Sanders said with his announcement, he has moved the dialogue and the party to the left. And as we saw in 2018, it was, as we saw with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she is the new face of the party. And of course, there are a lot of Democrats in the Midwest that said, wait a second. I don't think that's the way we're going to win. Just because Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez won in the Bronx doesn't mean she's going to win in Columbus or Cleveland or Cincinnati. So the party still, just as the Republican Party has to decide which way to go in 2016, the Democrats are still finding what makes sense and what wins in 2020. It's a great question, Bob, but I don't know if anybody has the answer.
Bob, thanks for that call. Chris in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
I had a question, what you just thought about how the superdelegates in the Democratic primary are going to go this time. Will they go what happened with Hillary Clinton last time, for lack of a better term, screwing over Bernie, like where Wisconsin gave 14 to Clinton but 7 to Bernie, even though he won the popular vote there?
What about that, Ken Rudin?
Well, that's a great question. Yeah. And New Hampshire is even a better example. Bernie Sanders got, I think, 60% of the vote in the New Hampshire primary. But because the superdelegates were on Hillary Clinton's side, it was very close in delegates. There is a rule change for 2020. And I think Bernie Sanders should take the credit for this. They've changed the rules that the superdelegates will not have a say until the convention or until late in the process. So in other words, they can't overrule what the voters have to say in the early primaries and caucuses. Their influence and effect are limited much because of the rule change, because Bernie felt that the deck was stacked against him with all these superdelegates for Hillary in 2016. So the rules have changed. We're not going to see the influence that superdelegates had in 2016. Let me just make one argument in favor of superdelegates. and I'm not saying this, this is what the argument is. I'm not saying I agree with it, but in 1972, when George McGovern took over the party, and yes, people were excited about him, and he was anti-war, and he was anti-establishment, and he wound up losing 49 states. Walter Mondale, was a loyal vice president, and, ran the party in 1984, and he lost 49 states. They created the superdelegates to say, wait a second, we need somebody who can win in November. Now, I understand the argument that people say that the supers fixed the system in favor of Hillary Clinton, and there's a legitimate argument to make about that. But anyway, whatever it is, they won't have the influence they had in the past.
Chris, thanks for that call. Now we're moving on to Andrew in Columbus. You're on the air. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a quick question. I mean, Ken mentioned a few minutes ago that Hillary got 3 million more votes than Donald Trump did in the last election, and yet he was still elected president. I just wanted to get his thoughts on that concept of the Electoral College and how even though she got more votes from the American people, she still lost the election because of Electoral College and specific amount of representatives for each state. And I just wanted to get his thoughts on the potential corruption or, ineffectiveness of the Electoral College.
Well, Donald Trump will argue that that's a great question. And it's a great question because the question, I mean, we heard the same question after 2000 when Al Gore got more votes than George W. Bush. And yet Bush, because he won Florida, got the 271 electoral votes needed to win. I mean, he got 271. He needed 270. But that's the way the Constitution is. And unless states are willing to change that, and you know that the smaller states like Iowa, like Nevada, like North Carolina, these New Hampshire, the so-called swing states, they're not going to give up their place in the sun, because if it was just popular vote, then nobody would bother going to New Hampshire or Nevada or Iowa. They'd hang out in California, Texas, New York, and Florida and Ohio, just the big populated states. I don't know if you need a constitutional amendment. Some states can change their laws some way. Like, for example, Nebraska and Maine have it that if you carry a congressional district, you get those electoral votes, plus you get votes for winning the whole state. They break it down by congressional district. But you just know that when a candidate loses the votes by 3 million, loses the election by 3 million, even though she has 3 million more votes than her opponent and loses, you know that something's wrong. But in fairness, Donald Trump will tell you that, look, if this was about popular election, then I would have campaigned in Texas and Florida nonstop. I would have campaigned in the state in Ohio constantly and drive up the vote. So look, I know what Democrats felt like after 2016, the way they felt after 2000. 2000 basically was elected. It was George Bush was elected by actually one vote. And that was a 5-4 vote in the Supreme Court. Right. Hillary Clinton, with her 3 million vote advantage, wasn't as fortunate in 2016.
Andrew, thanks for that question.
That's a great question.
Yeah. I mean, they're all good questions. And there's things, I mean, I hear people talking about the electoral votes, the Electoral College a lot. And they ask, when are you going to do something about it? And the states have to make the changes, and they can marginalize themselves by doing that.
The smaller states are never going to go along with it. Right. If you're New Hampshire, I'm not saying the New Hampshire primary, but in November, that's a key state. The presidential candidates only campaign in about 12 or 15 states. Nobody campaigns in Wyoming because it's safe Republican. Nobody campaigns in New York, basically, because it's safe Democratic. So something needs to change, but I think even more importantly is maybe if we got rid of this gerrymandering of districts that the Democrats were famous for in the 70s and 80s, the Republicans have taken it to an art form now, and that also is not a good thing for a small-D democracy.
What do we know right now about what constitutes the Trump base at this point? Is it as solid as a rock as it was? We know it is. His approval ratings are, but what does that say about the base?
The base is still there. You know, I mean, the numbers may not be as strong as they used to be. I think at one point it was like 93% among Republicans, which may be more than any Republican in history, except for the short time after 9/11 with George W. Bush. That number may be down to the low 80s, high 70s, but again, that's what's the problem with Bill Weld. Forget about the fact that Trump's numbers nationally are maybe mired in the low 40s. The Republican Party supports him, the voters support him, and I think that's one of the reasons there are so few instances of Republicans in Congress, Senate and House, standing up to the president, because they know if they do, they'll wind up like Mark Sanford did in South Carolina, and that is he'll just be beaten in the Republican primary. That's why Jeff Flake no longer has a political career, because once he started criticizing Trump, Republicans turned against him in Arizona. So until, you know, I'm wondering, until maybe if Robert Mueller comes up with something so horrific that there's a change in attitude in the Republican Party. But right now, this is his party. The question is whether the Democrats will be as energized as the Republicans seem to be. They weren't. Republicans weren't that energized in 2018, and the Democrats got success out of it. We'll see what happens in 2020.
Nancy Pelosi was returned to the speakership. You and I haven't been able to talk about that yet. I was wondering, well, how do you think she's doing?
Oh, my God. I mean, the thing is, during the campaign, there was no shortage of Democrats who said that she's old. I mean, she's 78 years old. And we're talking about all these people in the 70s. She's been in leadership for 15 years. She's tired. She needs to move aside. The fact that she outmaneuvered the president on this whole budget deal, the fact that, I mean, when we watched her with that maybe sarcastic applause during the State yes. of the Union, the same Democrats who've been blasting her as out of touch and past her prime, they say, my goodness, they love her. So it's funny how political fortunes can change so quickly. But right now, I think if you're a Democrat in the House, you absolutely like what Nancy Pelosi is doing for your party.
She definitely knows how to run the House. She's done that before. And it is interesting to see the likes of a Nancy Pelosi up against the likes of a Donald Trump. Where does Mitch McConnell fit into all of this anymore?
Well, look, Mitch McConnell still keeps his Republican conference in the Senate in line. This sounds more critical than I would like to say, but I think he has sold his principles a bit to make sure that the president's agenda is being passed. And look, if you're the Republican majority leader in the Senate, you want the Republican president to be successful. You want him to pass judges, and you want him to pass, you know, legislation like tax cuts. But there are so many Republican principles that the president seems to be violating on free trade and other things like that. And yet, you know, the president, Mitch McConnell, has just gone along with very little. Maybe there's behind the scenes criticism, but publicly there's not. And it's a little disappointing. And you just wonder if, you know, just like Paul Ryan, one day he'll say, I had enough and I'm just leaving. But for right now, he's the one who basically killed the Merrick Garland Supreme Court nomination that Barack Obama mm-hmm. tried to put in. I mean, that was
2 years ago,
unprecedented.
Now.
Mm-hmm.
Just about 2 years ago,
and distressing for a lot of people. But if you're a Republican senator, if you're a Republican president, I'm sorry, there's probably nobody I'd want running the Senate than Mitch McConnell, because he knows how the place works and he knows how to command loyalty.
Ken Rudin, thanks so much for joining us today. It's always a pleasure to have you on.
I love being on your show, Ann. Thanks so much.
That's Ken Rudin, political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. That's it. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Mary Lee Williams, assistant producer Kyle McKinnon. Our All Sides interns worked hard this week, Ray Brewster, Maisie Glockner, and Sophie Warner, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Alan DiCenzo is a composer of our theme music. Radio operations director Kevin Petrilla, senior broadcast technician Eric French, what would I do without you guys? WOSU News and Public Affairs director, my boss, Mike Thompson. Thanks to everybody, and thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Bye, Ken.